G'day and welcome to the Build Me a Brewery podcast, episode 4. If you're a first time listener to the podcast, I do highly recommend you to have a listen to our earlier episodes so you can become a bit more progressively informed as the series develops. And also, please make sure you like our Facebook page, simply Build Me a Brewery, and also visit our website, www.buildmeabrewery.com.au, and subscribe to our newsletter. We continue with the Meet the Brewer series, where I sit down with co-founders and head brewers from 6 Sydney breweries to get their stories, insights, and advice. In today's episode, I sit down with head brewer Dan Shaw from the Australian Brewery out in Rouse Hill, Sydney's northwest. Now, Dan, he joined the Australian back in its inception back in 2010, learning and succeeding from well-known figure in the industry, Neil Cameron. Dan's roots to the brewing industry came from working in the retail and hospitality industry, working for the Colosimo family, running their busy Hillside pub, and also working in management roles within Dan Murphy's. The Australian Brewery has been brewing in Sydney's Hills District since 2010 with champion trophies and over 15 gold medals won since 2016. Since Dan joined the brewery, the Australian has underwent a number of expansion projects with recent additional fermentation capacity, brewing efficiency improvements, and a brand new Palmer canning line. The Australian has also a very big contract brewing arm of the business and have been involved in brewing some of the biggest names in the craft beer space to date. We dive into once again the intricacies of gypsy and contract brewing, as well as equipment sourcing and tips and hints on developing a core range for new breweries. So let's get into it then. I do hope you enjoy my chat with Dan Shaw, head brewer of the Australian Brewery. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for having us out at the Australian Brewery.
No worries. Thanks for coming.
And as I've done in the past, I've normally given all our guests a short introduction on, you know, a bit about yourself, the brewery. Maybe if you want to give the listeners a bit more information about how you came to become the head brewer at Australian Brewery and what you were doing maybe in a past life.
Yeah, so I've been here since day one, or basically since day one. When I walked into the brewery, I got handed a stainless steel pipe and a clamp and said, got told to go and find where that goes to put the brewery together. Yeah. So I walked in, this is back in 2010. We only had tanks in place. We had no walls. We had no liquor license. We had nothing. We basically just had tanks in place. The hotel was all up and running. It had been open for a whole 3 days. They were just finishing off some things in the kitchen, but the actual production side of it wasn't. So that was in August 2010. We didn't actually brew our first beer until the week of Christmas 2010. So my background before that was basically always been the liquor industry. I worked for the owners that originally owned this brewery, the Colosimo family, over at a couple of their other pubs in Castle Hill, so Castle Hill Tavern and Hillside Hotel, back in the early 2000s. I was the licensee of Hillside Hotel for a couple of years and then decided to get out of hospitality. The hours were killing me. So mid-2000s, I moved out of hospitality into liquor retail and worked for Dan Murphy's for 5 years around the place over in your area in Penrith mostly. Yep. And then when 2010 rolled around, I'd always stayed close to the Cosmo boys and found out they were, well, was out to lunch with one of them and he was telling me about everything that was happening here. My wife, or my now wife, my girlfriend at the time, she sort of nudged me and said, well, why don't you ask for a job? You know, you want to go back and study and learn to do something different. Yeah. So why don't you ask for a job just to learn the brewing side of it? I asked and they said, yep, come out and meet Brian Watson, who was setting up the brewery for them. Came out and met Brian a couple of days later. I sort of chatted to him for about 2 hours. So my past work experience with the Colosimos and the okay from Brian, I got the assistant brewer job and then just worked my way through from there. We've only had one head brewer before me who left in 2016, Neil Cameron, and he left to go and do the New South Wales TAFE course. So he wrote the New South Wales TAFE course, and ran it for the first couple of years with a couple of other brewers and people in the industry. I moved into his role in 2016.
And as I was saying to Simon and the boys at the Rocks yesterday, Neil, his name's just popped up on, I think, every single episode.
Yeah, sure.
I'm trying to line up a meet and greet with him next week. But,
yep.
Well,
he's a busy man at the moment. He's setting up his own project too. Yeah. So, he won the... I don't think he was winning. He got...
Consultant? Was it Consultant of the Year or...
No, Contribution to the Industry. Last year, so he got the big award for that at the Indies last year. So that was a big feather in his cap for him, and well deserved. I mean, when we started here, there was 2010. There was only a handful of craft breweries happening. We made a lot of firsts, as I mentioned to you before. First craft brewery in Cairns. There was obviously the big boys were in Cairns previously, and Coopers were in Cairns, but I don't think they even sort of put themselves in that craft, which the term really no longer exists anymore, but that craft wing of the beer industry. So we were the first ones to sort of adapt to the can side of it. That was solely through Neil's push on it. He could see it happening. He could see the change happening in America. And the cycle pretty much goes that Australia's about, we're probably less now, but back then we're about 5 years behind the American industry. And it just cycles through. What happens there happens here, and we just wanted to get ahead of the curve on that one.
Yeah, okay. And so, yeah, you were in and around the beer or brewing industry and liquor industry prior to coming to the Australians. So did that experience sort of help you into the brewing side, or were you also a brewer, home brewer? Or?
No, I did very rudimentary Cooper's kits.
As everyone does starting out.
Exactly. back in the day, one of my friends was doing it and I was around his place. I'm like, yeah, you know what? This is pretty good and cheap. So let's give this a go. But a couple of batches of that. Knew nothing about sanitation at those days. So a couple of sour ones down the drain. That was about the extent of my home brewing. I sort of moved out into this industry a couple of years after I started to do that. So once you make it every day and you get beer from here, there's not a lot of point at making it home and spending another 6 hours at home doing the same thing that you've just done here.
Yeah.
Previously from that, though, when I was working for the Klosmos out at Hillside Hotel, one of the hotels they owned in their group was Potter's Brewery up at the Hunter Valley. And the Hunter Brewing Company was at Potter's, so I had a little bit of exposure to it there. That was probably my earliest exposure to the actual physical brewing side of it in 2004 maybe.
Okay.
Something around there.
Yeah. All right. So I know that it was the Colosimo family that was sort of involved probably more in the actual physical building of the brewery, or, you know, getting it compliant and commissioned. But are you able to sort of talk a bit about, you know, maybe your role or what you know of the building process and how the Australian Brewery came to be?
Yeah, well, I mean, they did the original part of it. Yep. But me and Neil, everything from the original brewery, me and Neil both came in after all of that sort of side of it came from the initial layout side of it.
Yep.
But everything that we've done since then, I've been 100% part of. So all of the tank expansion, so expanding out into car parks and DAs and everything like that, the biggest thing that we're dealing with even currently now is establishment of a proper water treatment plant, so a wastewater treatment plant, yep, working for Sydney Water. Putting in solid settlements, solid settlement tanks, getting all that approved by Sydney Water, and that's a big thing that takes part in, not so much when we were doing it, because the brewing side of it fell into a very black spot in those days. There wasn't enough independent brewers, microbrewers, for Sydney Water to even classify breweries as outside of a food manufacturing plant. So once Sydney Water started to understand uh, the amount of water that was used, the how the product was made, everything like that. They started to roll out probably 2015, 2016, a different level of water treatment needed. And everybody that's come built their brewery since has been able to incorporate that into their build, which makes a massive difference to setting it up, and has been probably the biggest hurdle. I've been working on this water treatment system since 2016.
Wow.
And it's become a different beast over all these years because our production has increased. We've put in more tanks, we've put in new equipment. So we've put one thing in and we've met requirements for Sydney Water for 6 months, and then our business has jumped again, and they've gone, okay, well, you're not meeting requirements, you now got to do this, and now got to do this, and now you got to do this.
So the volume of water that you've been using, you've then got to, you know, obviously update things with Sydney Water.
Yeah, a huge amount of things. Not just the pure volume of water, it's the quality of the water going out, the pH, suspended solids. They measure grease, but obviously we don't have any grease going through the brewery, but you can pick up grease from floors, nitrogen levels, biological oxygen demand. So every time your production increases, all of those numbers increase, but they might not increase at the same rate. So you might be putting a different countermeasure in for whatever's sort of going out of spec.
Yeah.
Each time. So
I think this is the first episode that we've actually touched on the water side, actually. We've talked about water profiles and RO systems for the water filtration, but
yep.
Another area that I was hoping to explore at some point during the podcast was the Sydney Water or you know, the wastewater treatment side of things. And I think it's a forgotten thing that a lot of aspiring brewery owners tend to don't take into account, because there's a bit of money that you need to spend to make sure that you're doing right by the water waste or wastewater side.
Yeah, 100%. So you've got two ways you can basically look at it. Do it right from the start, spend the upfront money to, I guess, future-proof yourself a little bit. Or you can do it the cheaper upfront way, which will cost you longer in the long run, because Sydney Water will charge you for... If you've got too much suspended solid in there, they'll charge you for treatment of suspended solid, removal of suspended solid. So your quarterly waste charges will be higher than what it would be if you put that initial outlay. But it is definitely one of those things that does get forgotten or maybe pushed to the side, saying, oh, we don't want to spend $70,000 on a future-proof water treatment when we can spend $70,000. That $70,000 can go into buying us a better packaging line, and when we increase our output through that packaging line and our profits are increasing coming in, then we'll deal with a larger waste treatment. So it definitely is one of those things that gets pushed. The good thing is, I don't know if Sydney Water really would like me saying this, but they don't actually fine you, so it's not, we're going to cut off your supply of water, but your charges do increase significantly. We were in the higher teens at one stage for a quarterly water charge, and we were able to reduce that significantly by spending $5,000 on pH treatment and a settlement tank. That was in the early times. We're now well past that now, so we're doing that again, but on a much larger, much more sophisticated phase.
And you guys, as we were talking earlier off air, you guys have played a real big part in a lot of gypsy brewers and contract brewers and who have now become well-known names in the craft beer industry. Tell us a bit about the contract brewing gypsy side that you guys have played a part in. We spoke with Simon and Addy from Rocks in the earlier episode, and they gave a bit of detail about that, but tell us about Australian Brewery's sort of angle on the contract brewing side.
Yeah, so we've always been big on the contract side. So we've always wanted to include contract brewing in a large proportion of what we do day to day, week to week. With the original idea and the every expansion we've done has basically taken into account that we want to be doing about 40% contract brewing and about 60% of our own. So once we sort of meet those parameters, we go, okay, well, we've now met this goal, so we need to put some new equipment in or some new tank space or change our canning line up to increase our efficiency so we can now expand both of those more, larger output. For the individual contract brewing side, we've brewed a lot of stuff for breweries before they've had their own brewery. And that really came from having our own packaging line on site and being cans as well. So a lot of the new breweries wanted to, they saw the writing on the wall as well, even in some of the early days, so mid 2015, 2016. When we'd been already running for 5 years and had a canning line for 3 years. So these guys were wanting to test the water with their, not only their product, but see where the cans were being more accepted. So we were a good choice because we've got 4,000 litre tanks. We can do 2,000 litres in those 4,000 litre tanks. So we could do some smaller batches for people to just go out without them breaking the bank. If they had a brand, they could get a small amount of beer made, find their footing a little bit, find their customer base, and then expand out from there.
So would you recommend aspiring home brewer that's been all grain brewing for, say, a couple of years, that has a few recipes dialed in, they might have a pale ale, an IPA or whatever, what advice would you give them when they're wanting to make the jump from just backyard brewing to maybe doing their first 2,000, 4,000 litre batch, contract brewing?
Ducks in a line.
Yep.
Make sure everything is lined up before you hit that go button. There's no point in having a finished product in package sitting in a warehouse, getting old, costing you storage space, all that sort of stuff. So as exciting as it is to have that first beer made and packaged and ready to go, if you don't have sales points, if you don't have people pushing the product, whether it's the person doing themselves, whether it's friends and family, whatever that infrastructure is for a smaller startup company, if you don't have that, you're not going to be around for long.
So Dan, the focus for a gypsy brewer not only should be about getting their recipe right, working with you guys to make sure it's dialed in and it's tasting where they want it to be, but what else would you advise them, on the sales side and getting in line before they put down money for contract brewing?
Yeah, so definitely the advertising side of it. Mm-hmm. So the small cost of large exposure of social media advertising, push the brand early. Make it aware, build your customer base, get people asking for it. You can have posters printed to go up in local bottle shops that are going to be stocking the beers. If you're going package, you can start pushing, if hotels are doing, if it's going to be package, keg stock, sorry, you get hotels to start advertising it, that when it'll be released. Those sort of things, go into collaboration with a bottle shop for your first product. That way you take a little bit of extra stress off yourself financially, and you have a sales point straight up that you can go to people. Yes, it is packaged. It is there 2 days after the packaging date. Go to these guys and buy it. Give them exclusivity for X amount of time.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
Those sort of things, just ease your financial burden as much as you can, and get people wanting to buy that product. The faster they buy that product, the faster the bottle shops are going to pay you, the faster you can move on to your next one. And if you stick to that model for the first 2 to 3 years and try and have everything promoted and pushed well before it comes out, even pre-sold to bottle shops or hotels, depending on which what you're putting it into, you will succeed. You won't financially burden yourself. You won't double mortgage your house. You won't do anything like that. You'll be able to, if you want to go into your own brewery after that, you'll be well on the way. You'll have a base customer base. You'll probably even know what area of your main city is selling the most product. You can get so much information from sellers these days. And I mean, you'll see yourself too, who you're selling to. And then that just gives you a better foothold for if you want a physical brewery from a gypsy brewer, you can then pick the area where the people are buying the most product and set your brewery up there if it works for you. Mm. But if it's in Sydney, like if it's at the Inner West and you're selling it most through the Inner West, look for another spot in the Inner West. I mean, people are loving the amount of breweries that are in there because you can walk to them all and they're all doing really well. So those sort of things about setting your product, setting yourself up to succeed rather than having any hurdles.
With the Gypsy Brewing side as well, I was talking to Simon and Addy the other episode earlier where they were talking about how they charge and what sort of contracts and agreements that would have in place. What would the Australian Brewery Standard Agreement look like? Would it be per batch or per litre or per keg? Is there a standard across the industry? Or
I'm not sure if there's a standard across the industry, to tell you the truth, because it's probably something I've never really looked at outside of this our own venue, and we've always brewed everything of our own. We've done one contract brew with a large brewery in Melbourne, when we couldn't fill it here. We had a large export deal. We couldn't fill it here, so we got them to deal with our domestic stuff while we made the export stuff. Mm-hmm. What we do is we have a co-pack fee per case or per keg. It doesn't matter what size the case is, if it's 16s, yeah, if it's 18s, if it's 24s, it all scales with the size that it is. Yeah. And that's, if somebody just asked me how much does it cost to make a beer, you go, okay, well, it costs your base product plus the co-pack fee. And that's the simplest way, without having a recipe, it's the simplest way. Some people could, I guess, cost up their own recipe to an extent, and then they could add that co-pack fee, which I tell them, on top of that, and then they would have a general price. We do slight varying in co-packs for larger volumes, but then there's differences in beers too. Some are filtered, some are not filtered, some take more time, some don't. So it varies a little bit there too, yeah, but the co-pack fees basically the same for everybody.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. So, lessons learned. I know that once again that you came shortly after the initial build of the brewery, but you've been in the industry for many years now. You've seen a lot of breweries come and go, and probably been involved in some other startups and provided advice. What would you say are the biggest challenges facing an aspiring brewery owner?
For a physical brewery?
Yeah.
Definitely layout of site. It's kind of hard to say, look at things from different angles. Always make sure everything's big enough. And that's not just talking about your floor space or anything about it like that. It's talking about your doorways. Make sure your doorways are big enough to get pallets of cans through, or pallets of bottles.
One thing they'll probably overlooked, I guess, yeah.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you've got, if you think in the future you're going to expand, that you have access to put this new equipment in. Think about that to start with, where you're going to lay it all out. It might look nicer in an area, but be completely impractical if you, 6 months down the track, you think you're going to have enough money to buy a packaging line. And then you go, okay, well, I want to put the packaging line there because I want the people at the front of house to be able to see the packaging line. But you can't do that now because you put the brew house there, and now your packaging line's stuck behind that. Or you're going to spend $100,000 moving your brew house, undoing all your steam lines or your power lines or your water, and moving your brew house to put the fancier piece of equipment up front. So those sort of things, you're never not going to need more room. We've been here, we've added so many bits and pieces on and taken more car park, but we had the advantage to do that because we did have that external car park area to move into.
So just try and
look at those things through, I guess, take a step back from the madness of organising it and the excitement of organising it and wanting it to get it open by a certain date, and just try and look at it through a different lens.
So just on the topic of core beer range, I know that you guys have got about six beers in your core range and you've won quite a few awards and medals over the last few years. We're drinking your popular IPA at the moment, which you win a champion medal for, is that right?
We've won a lot of golds for that one. Yep. Unfortunately, we've never won a trophy for it, but we've won a lot of golds.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
I think it had a 7 or 8 gold medal streak for 2 or 3 years. So it was pretty good for that one.
So I guess and when I was out visiting Pete out at Wayward, he shared a couple of comments about or some advice on, you know, a new brewery starting out and how many beers they should have in their core beer range. Maybe you want to provide some comments about that?
Yeah, it's probably one thing I've thought a lot about, probably even more recently. We've had the basically the same core range since about 2016, when we changed from 355 mil cans to 375 mils. So it's long overdue for us to maybe do a clean wipe and start again of our core range. The industry's changed a lot. We were one of the early adapters for this IPA, which was a 4.5% or 4.3% session IPA. Our pale ale is a Pacific pale ale. We've got our Sazamanos, which is a Mexican lager. And then a couple of dark beers and that too. So it's all of these beers have been around for quite a while in some guys. So have thought about a lot. What I would like to see would be probably 3 to 4 core range in keg and package. Then maybe have something that's like our stout that is just package. Just keg, so just on tap. And then maybe something that's just package as well.
Mm.
I probably wouldn't start a new business that way, but because we've got quite a few sales points, we've kind of got the ability to do that. For a startup, I would definitely be looking at, if you were going to do a core range, 3 beers. Don't overstretch yourself. You can always add more, especially if you're going cans over bottles and you want to go printed cans. Minimum order quantity for printed cans is 60,000 units. That's a lot of can shells if a beer is only selling a pallet every now and then kind of thing. That's, once again, that's upfront outlay for those can shells. You're now locked into that product for those 60,000 units, or you pull the pin and you scrap that range. You deal with the costing of it and you do something else that's going to work. It's easy to say do something different, but, I mean, there's so much out there in the market now that it's a bit hard to find that little niche. What I would say, instead of doing something different, do something well. Do something well and own it. You've seen that succeed so many times with Stone and Wood Pacific Ale, more recently Bolter XPA, Filter XPA, and then there's quite a few others that I can't think of right off. Young Henry's Newtowner.
Mm-hmm.
They've picked something and they've owned it. They've backed it 100% all the way. They've always been good. They've always been consistent, but they've owned it. There's been nothing... then they're not going triple hazy IPA as a part of a core range. They're picking something simple that is going to sell a lot of, picking the packaging, picking the design and going from there.
Yeah, excellent. That was great insight. And talking to Addy from Rocks, he mentioned a good pale ale and an IPA would be a good way to start out. And then Pete from Wayward was saying, the more SKUs you add to your core range, the more infrastructure and the more planning that needs to go into place to sort of keep that demand there. So for a new brewery starting out, you'd probably want to start smaller.
Yeah, 100% agree. We went through a phase probably 2 years ago now. We had 13 products that were either keg and package, keg or just package, and then a couple of other bits and pieces that we do for some people. And that was 13. That was before we even brought in any contract brewing. That was 13 just in-house, and it was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it was all because there was some styles or products that just needed to die. They needed to be put to bed. And move on to the next thing. They were either outdated styles that we were doing, that had some very loyal customer base, but not enough to sustain it. When you looked at the actual numbers, and customers are everything, but if you're only making one beer that's going to sit around for 6 months and you've got 10 people drinking it, that's costing you. You just have to apologize to these people, and if they're loyal enough to your brand, they're going to move on to the next thing you make.
Going back to lessons learned, what would you say an aspiring brewery owner should be focusing on? Number one thing they should be focusing
number
on.
Number one.
When they're starting out, I guess maybe they've engaged council and they're starting their process. I mean, Pat from Willie's mentioned, you know, council is a big part of the planning process. Should engage your local council early on. Any other thoughts that you'd like to share on the planning stage?
Yeah, don't stinge on your equipment. If you're setting up a physical brewery, your equipment is, Neil drummed into me from a very early stage, I'll say the polite version of it, crap in, crap out. So if you're making rubbish product, it's going to be rubbish coming out of the other end. So your equipment, people say that the brewer themselves makes the beer. I would agree to about 80% of that. But if you've got bad equipment that's not clarifying your wort properly, if your kettle's not boiling properly, if your boiler's undersized, all that sort of stuff, because you've tried to save a little bit of money by going, oh, yeah, well, okay, that's just close enough to what I need. Instead of going, no, that one's quite well above what I need, always go the well above. You spend that money now, it's going to make you money in the long run.
Right, okay. And have you been involved in the sourcing part of equipment before?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So other than the equipment that was here, I've been part of every single thing that went out that's come into the brewery. So that was the original cask canning line that we put in 2012. Yep. The larger HGM tanks that were not larger, sorry, the newer HGM tanks we put in, installation of new bright tanks, installation of cooling systems, installation of the Palmer canning line that we now have, all systems like that, building extensions of the buildings, warehousing, reinforcing floors, structural concrete. You name it.
Yeah. And other than, you know, not being stingy when you, you know, because I guess every brewery or aspiring brewery owner is always going to be thinking about money as probably the number one priority. Do I have enough to start out? And should we start small and then look at expanding? But then you hear a lot of stories about those breweries wishing they started out bigger in the first instance. Any other advice that you would give those people on when they're sourcing equipment? Like, you know, there's talk of people getting a lot of their equipment from China, but then there's, you know, yes, it's probably cheaper, but what's the quality going to be like? And how do you know what the quality is? Is it going to do the job, or is it going to, you know, blow a gasket or fall to bits in a couple of years' time? Like, maybe share some advice on how they should approach that.
We're lucky we're in an industry where, as far as I know, there's only two brewers I've met in my 10 years that I haven't gotten along with. So we've all got different equipment. A lot of us have got very similar equipment. Some of us have exactly the same equipment. Call around. Find out who's got the equipment that you're looking at, because somebody's going to have something.
Yep.
If it's not in your city, it's definitely going to be somebody in the country who's going to have it. Yep. And they can talk you through it. They'll happily talk you through it. I've never found a brewer that I've asked, it's even somebody that I don't know that I've met through somebody else, just called them out of the blue and said, hey, I'm looking at buying X piece of equipment. How do you find it? Nah, it's shit. Okay, no worries. I'll keep looking. Yeah, no, it's great. It's great value for money. Or it might be a little bit pricey, but you know what? It works out in the end. It saves you time. It's safer. It's whatever you want. But we all get along. I mean, it's beer, man. I mean,
it's hard not to, I guess.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, we all get along. We all share ideas. We all share recipe secrets. I mean, it just works. I mean, it's probably one of the rare industries where we're not at each other's throats. We're all trying to work together for the better of the industry, because us all working together in the end raises everybody. I mean, if more people are moving over to the independent beers, rather than the major beers. I mean, it's good. I mean, once you, I guarantee you know yourself, you would have started at a point, you would have tried one thing, probably from a major brewer, and then you've gone, yeah, okay, you know what, that tastes pretty good. I might try this. And then, oh, you know what, that's good. These guys make the same style. I might try their beer. And then, okay, their beer was really good. Let me try the rest of their beers in their core range. Okay, well, that was pretty good. They're going to be now my staple for the next 6 months, but I'm going to buy a six-pack of that and one of those and one of those and one of those. And we all work together. So the freedom of information, in going back to the original point, the freedom of information in this industry is there.
Yep.
Utilize it. Use it. Go and visit your breweries. Probably call first, but if the brewer says, yep, come in, have a chat, come in for a day and see that piece of equipment working before you buy it. Come and use it first. Guarantee 95% of the time, that's the response you're going to get.
Yeah, that's good advice, and that is a common theme, right, throughout my journey of talking to brewers and the community. Is, you know, so everyone's so forthcoming with information, and you know, and that I haven't come across any arseholes. So yeah, I don't know what those two that you met are like in person. So
you probably won't come across them. They're still around, but they probably won't even take your phone call.
Yeah, well, I'll cross them off the list. Now, getting your, I guess, insights about the industry. You've been around the industry for quite a number of years now. You've come across a lot of things that have come and go, beer trends. Where do you see the craft beer industry going?
I think we're on a trajectory now. There is some whispers of self-implosion, and because we've moved away from, we were talking about core range earlier, and that's why I was saying go small, because if one doesn't work and you've already got packaging for that, you're kind of stuck with it, or you're gonna waste that money, kind of thing. We've gone from, everybody basically had a core range. You might do a seasonal twice a year, or you might do a seasonal on the season, so you might do four. We've now gone to a lot of places, some breweries, that's all they do. They don't have a core range. They've found such a footing that they can just pump out these different beers all the time.
Yeah, a bit like Wildflower. Is it Wildflower?
Wildflower, yep. Mountain Culture. Mountain Culture do have a core range, but it's not really what they're known for. Yep. I don't even know if Deeds down in Vic have a core range. All I ever see is their I say this in quotation marks, in seasons, their new thing. But that's they found that. So I don't know whether that is an overall sustainable trend. Eventually, we're going to run out of ideas, and we're going to start repeating people and repeating styles and repeating other brands, things, and that'll work into a whole bunch of different confusion and issues on its own. But I think I'd like to think we'll see, when all the venues reopen, we might see a return to a more sort of established core range and a more consistent making of a core range. Don't get me wrong, I love making seasonals, I love doing something different, but the core range basically pays the bills.
And there's so many commitments that you have with your core range as well, especially with your distributors as well, and your customer base, I guess.
So, yeah, definitely. I mean, if that's the business you've built for yourself, yeah definitely, 100%. But if your business is built on always having something new, then that's what your customer core base is really going for. Yeah. So, I don't know. It is a hard one. We're very much in a middle area at the moment. That core range, as we've already spoken about, is an important thing. But having something new, and I guess it's a little bit of an issue with the whole social media generation, that they are looking for something new, they are looking for something different all the time, constantly. That's all that's happening. So we might have worked ourselves into that corner a little bit. But at least it's a fun corner to be in. It's an experimental corner. So, whether that continues or whether we go back to a core range area, I don't know.
Because you're seeing a big push for hazies at the moment.
Yep.
Sours, the Nipahs and the IPAs and the Powers, they've sort of been in the market for quite some time now. Any beers left field that I've not heard of or maybe the average punter maybe hasn't heard of that's going to make a big push in the next coming years?
I don't think so. I think, like I was saying much earlier on, that we're those few years behind America. I think we're on that IPA scene. We're very much catching them now. So if something happens there, if someone does something well there, it's here within a couple of months. Maybe not on the production side of it. We were long to catch up on the cans and everything like that. They'll do something new soon, and we'll take a little while if it takes more equipment. We've caught up on styles quite a bit quicker now. I find it really hard to think that there would be a huge turn away from the juggernaut that is hazies and sours and things like what we are actually at the moment. That came in. There's been a few other things that have peaked in. So Brut IPAs, that came and went very quickly. Like the Gozers are still there. People still make them. They still sell well. They're really good beers. But that sort of tapered off a little bit as well. So I think definitely those hazy sours. I really hope that some really good West Coast IPAs make a re-emergent. That's probably my go-to style over the hazies. I find a lot of the hazies taste very similar. Good beers, great beers, but I'd rather sit all night on a West Coast IPA. So that's something that I hope will peak back in 6 months, a year, 2 years, and maybe take dominance again. So
yeah. And I've noticed with the IPA, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because I guess you're seeing a lot of hoppy type beers coming out now, where they're sort of masking that malt type flavour of the beer. And you guys have a bit of a very malt forward type IPA here. Is that something that sort of stems from your sort of taste and style?
Yeah, it definitely is. It's got that malt forward body, but one thing I really dislike about West Coast, some West Coast IPAs, especially mostly from America, Australians don't seem to do it, which is great, is it doesn't have a sticky sweet body. That's definitely my personal taste. I would say 90% of the Australian made West Coast IPA styles are excellent beers. They're not sticky. They're fairly dry. They've got a little bit of residual sweetness in there, but not something as high as what the Americans leave in. But that was a very specific choice for this beer because it is lower in alcohol. So we wanted to make sure we had that sort of malt flavored body there with some crystal malts and that there to fill in, I guess, a bit of an overall gap with a lower alcohol. We weren't. It's dry hopped mostly like a West Coast IPA, but once again we had to dial that back a little bit because it is still a session IPA. But that was a very conscious choice. One thing we are thinking about bringing into Core Range in the future is maybe the big brother of this. So a larger 6%, 6.5% West Coast IPA. With that similar malt profile with the hop profile, but just so basically we can throw some more hops in a beer.
Yeah, okay. And what would you say, I've talked to some of the other brewers who have shared some comments about the industry and certain things that are probably holding back the industry still. There has been a lot of things with local and state government that has improved things, especially with the excise rebates and all that.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to share some comments about how, government and how maybe the IBA can help better lobby for things to make the craft beer industry grow more?
Yeah, I mean, the IBA has been great. I mean, it really has. It's I've been around well before they started, and we were originally part of the New South Wales Brewers Guild, and then that sort of split off into the CBIA, which is now the IBA, and I forget what the other acronym was that the other end used. But that split off into two bodies, and obviously the CBIA was the one that sort of grew and evolved into what is now our IBA. And they've only been around for, off the top of my head, 3 or 4 years. So that we've still got a lot of growing as an industry and them as an industry body doing as much as they can for the overall industry. So for them, I think they do a fantastic job. The people that run it are great. You've already spoken to Pete from Wayward, so yep. he's one of the...
Yeah, he's one of the chairman, and he's part of the Inner West Brewers Association
yeah,
as well.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've known Pete for a long time, and he's just such a passionate, intelligent man that it gives me a huge amount of confidence that he drives it so much as much as what he does. For the government side of things, they did change with the excise rebates, the changing the excise from for 30-litre kegs, so anything under 50-litre kegs made a difference. It's still the package. The package kills us. The excise on a can is much, much larger than the excise on a keg itself. But especially during these times, COVID times, when you had no keg sales, so your package sales is what kept your business alive. If we could have already gotten the government to play ball on that side of it, which I know the IBA was working very strongly during that time frame, to get them to do this, to drop the excise on the packaging, to make that money stay with the business, to keep those businesses going. I mean, we must be a very, very small amount of the independent brewers must be a very small amount of the excise tax that goes into the government itself. So just give these guys a break. I mean, we're big enough that we're able to sustain ourselves, but some of the startup guys, I mean, give them a 12-month break, give them a 5-year break on excise tax, even if it's a 50% rate, and in 5 years you go up, you'd be getting so many more people doing creative things and being able to do a dream job rather than just slogging themselves away at a job that they don't like, losing their health and end up costing the government more money through healthcare.
Absolutely. Yeah, so just giving them a bit of a breather when they start out. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, new business, give a breather. If it's not kegs, if it's not a cut rate on kegs, give them a cut rate on cans or bottles or whatever they want to do. Especially if they're doing the right things, like bottles, cans over bottles. I know that was one thing on your list. If they're doing that, your impact on the environment's lower. CO2 emissions are lower because they're lighter, they're more recyclable, everything like that. I mean, if they're going to do the right thing, set some parameters. If you do X, Y, Z, you get an excise cut for 3 years, your first 3 years. So if you then, they do R&D grants each year. I don't know what it is at the moment, but they make the R&D grant. If you spend X amount on R&D and if you get through that 3 years and you spend X amount on R&D to improve your processes or whatever, get another excise cut, things like that. I think there's a lot of things they could do.
And I guess moving into the next area for the industry side, the COVID side, do you think COVID will maybe push the government to make a lot more of those concessions and make it a bit easier for small businesses?
I think so. Whether that translates just from small business through to brewery-specific things, I don't know. I haven't really looked too much at the budget stuff. I know Peter sent out an IBA newsletter a couple of days ago about the budget that was released on Tuesday. I haven't fully read through that yet and what implications that has it on. One thing that I do remember him putting in there was something about trainees. And that's another area that can help starting breweries as well. If somebody can get a traineeship in a established brewery, they can learn their skills there. They can learn the do's and the don'ts and or everything that we're speaking about here for themselves firsthand. They can see what works. They can see what doesn't. They can see the mistakes in the buildings and things like that. And then when they go to do it, they're going to be more likely to be successful and everything. So, I mean, I think that's a good point. Whether we get anything specific, I don't know.
Yeah. And how has the Australian managed the COVID situation since March?
So we, once again, we're in a very good position when it happened because we had our own packaging line. We actually always keep our keg stock quite low. We did get caught a little bit, two of our suppliers, just before, or distributors, I should say, the week before the shutdown happened, ordered a huge amount of kegs. So we made them all and sent them out because a lot of the hotels were starting to buy up, wondering what transport lines and things would be from places. So we made a lot of kegs. The Sunday they pulled the pin on the country basically, and those suppliers or those distributors then sent all of those kegs back to us. So then we had to work out an efficient way to move the keg product into package product, and without hurting the products too much, or we had to store some of the kegs in the hopes that the hotels would open up again. So that impact is there, but on the other side of it, we have our own packaging line. So we were able to take everything that we had in tank and just put it straight in package.
Yeah, well, that would have been convenient because, yeah, I know a lot of like East Coast canning, all those mobile canning places would be under the pump in those first couple of months.
100%.
Repackaging everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So coming towards the end, and once again, Dan, I appreciate you sharing a bit of time with us, but any closing thoughts and advice for aspiring brewery owners?
Take your time, think about it, don't get caught up in the hype of it, and just plan. Just think about it, step back. If you're going to do something next week, just hold off and do it 2 weeks after that. Just give yourself some breathing space and some time to think about it. Shop around, speak to the people in the industry, get it right the first time. You do not want to spend the money and do it a second time, because that'll just break you.
Yeah. And anything that you'd like to sort of mention about the brewery, in terms of anything you'd like to plug, new beers coming out, events or anything?
Yes, actually we've been a long time since we've done any seasonals or any new beers. We had planned to do some sort of roughly January, February, but we did kind of see a little bit of the writing on the wall with COVID and just held off a little bit. So we actually haven't released a seasonal now for, oh God, I can't even remember, probably almost 2 years now. So we've kind of gone, okay, we need to do it. So a couple of weeks ago, we got all of our ideas together. We picked two or three, and we got a whole bunch of labels all printed up together. So not next week, 2 weeks after this, which will be the, I don't know when this is coming out, but that'll be the 26th week, starting 26th of October, I think. No, week starting 19th of October. We'll be packaging and releasing our Dark and Tart, which is my senior brewer's brainchild. It is a chocolate and mixed berry sour. A dark sour. So that was made by Charlie. Two of the other brewers, they have done a Hazy Mandarin IPA, which will be released 2 weeks after that, so start of November. And we've gone back and each year we do a pina colada NEIPA, milkshake NEIPA with the Bucket Boys guys. Yep. So Penrith Bucket Boys and Marrickville Bucket Boys.
Yep. Yeah, hoping to get those guys on, actually.
Yeah.
John and Clint. So
Jonathan
hopefully
Clint.
Getting them on, talking about distribution. Yep.
Yeah, they're good guys. So we do the pina colada with them. We've done it for probably the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years. So we've got the next batch of that coming out late November. So those are three seasonals, and then we're just going to do that every 2 or 3 months, and we're only going to make 150 cases of each, and when they're sold, they're sold. A lot of them have pre-sold already, but there will be a large amount of stock that will be available here at the hotel. Like a lot of the other breweries too, we've done a seltzer range, so the seltzers are...
Yeah, that's starting to make a bit of a push.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird thing, but we've done four flavors, and we packaged the first ones off yesterday, and all four flavors will be available in a couple of weeks, and they're going well on tap so far, and the package will be the next one as well. So we're actually doing a lot of new stuff that we haven't done for a long time. We've sort of just been plodding along with core range and contract stuff, and now we're...
Yeah, excellent. And where can people reach you guys?
That is a very good question. I don't do social media, so I have no idea.
Well, I assume on you've got a pretty detailed website. People can purchase things online.
I don't know at the moment. So most of our core range we sell through Boozbud, so boozbud.com. That's always been our online portal. So anything from the Australian Brewery website goes straight through to Boozbud for online shopping. I'm pretty sure we're Australian. We might be Oz Brewery on Instagram and Australian Brewery on Facebook. And then beer at australianbrewery.com.au is our email.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Dan. And I appreciate you taking the time. Everyone, Dan Shaw from the Australian Brewery.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Build Me a Brewery podcast, and I do hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please remember to like, follow, or subscribe across all our social media handles. And if you visit our website, www.buildmeabrewery.com.au, and subscribe to our mailing list, you can get exclusive content such as free ebooks and transcripts on all our podcast episodes. So keep on listening and stay tuned for more episodes of the Build Me a Brewery podcast.